a hollow gesture today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and orders the State Department to begin plans to move the U.S. Embassy there from Tel Aviv. Some Israelis cheer, but not all of them.
I see a city that is divided, contested, unsustainable, and no hollow gesture of recognizing or moving a capital is going to change that.
Plus, think before you buy.
It's important to think about every time we purchase an item of clothing that there is a person behind that process. And if something is really inexpensive, then somebody is paying the price for that.
Our series Wear and Tear continues today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're back on the assembly line today with our series this week, Wear and Tear, about the women who make our clothes. This factory is in Bangladesh, in the capital Dhaka, just a few miles, in fact, from the Rana Plaza factory that collapsed 4 years ago, killing over 1,000 people, almost all of them garment workers. The disaster prompted a lot of soul-searching in the West about where we get our clothes from, who makes them, and under what conditions. Today, our Women's Lives reporter Jasmine Garz goes to the Bangladeshi capital Dhaka for answers.
What if she hadn't lost her shoe that day? Aratibala does wonders about this sometimes. Arati is 20 years old, and she sometimes replays this moment from 4 years ago in her mind, when she scrambled to find her missing sandal as the walls and the ceiling around her crumbled. She was working on a sewing machine when she heard a bang. She says the building shivered. Her supervisor told everyone to run, and Arati, who often slipped her shoes off at work, searched for her sandal. "Just run," the supervisor said. She sprinted and tripped. She doesn't remember anything else.
The death toll continues to rise following the collapse of a building in Bangladesh on Wednesday morning. At least 175, mainly women workers, are now known to have died, with a rescue operation to free many more.
The images of the collapsed Rana Plaza factory show a pile of cement and iron rods tangled with human limbs and fabric. Fabric that was destined to be made into clothing for big brand stores. Arati was trapped under all that, her legs stuck under another worker's body. By the time she woke up to the sound of rescuers, Arati had been buried for 3 days. Her mother, who worked at the same factory, died in the collapse. Arati was taken to the hospital, where they had to amputate her leg.
Rescue teams have been frantically working to find survivors, but the cries of those trapped became weaker through the night. At one point, the screams stopped.
It was the deadliest accident in garment industry history, and it was an accident waiting to happen. The building had not been built to house thousands of workers operating heavy machinery. Additional floors had been added illegally. The day before the collapse, managers found deep fissures in the structure. They sent Arati and her co-workers home for the day, but they told the workers to come back the next morning. Where Rana Plaza used to be, there is now nothing. It's a monumental nothingness. It's just an empty lot with overgrown bushes and mounds of garbage. And every morning, thousands of workers, mostly women, walk past it on the way to the factories. Here at the Waymart factory in Dhaka, they make clothing for the British retailers Debenhams and Next.
Buyers have become more alert than before.
Adrian Rodriguez is the merchandising manager here. He meets us in his office. He says after Rana Plaza, retailers really did change their procedure.
They will send the whole compliance team to check the building safety, to check the electrical safeties, to check the structural safety, how compliant we are, whether we are giving proper facilities to the workers, whether the workers are happier. So overall, buyers are more pushy nowadays for safety.
And he says Rana Plaza taught the industry two things. First, as much as consumers love a bargain, they don't want blood on their hands. And second, Bangladeshi factory owners are learning the value of better working conditions.
They have seen that if they are behaving better with the employees, if they are giving better facilities, they are getting the products out better.
Out on the production floor, rows of workers, almost all women, hunch over their tables, their needles making tracks through the denim. It's hot in here, and the fans seem to just push warm air around. This is not a cushy job. The hours are long, the work is repetitive, and it's physically draining. But we're told the building has been checked by structural engineers and that the workers are taught emergency procedures.
We have safety drills and announced drills on a regular basis.
These are all great improvements, and yet activists say there's a long way to go.
These jobs, it is not with respect. These jobs is not with dignity.
Kalpona Akhtar worked in these factories as a child. She's now a union leader, and she understands what a delicate battle this is. 20% of this country's GDP comes from garment production. No one wants to shoo away foreign investment.
We are talking about our growing economy, which is really needed, but in the same time, we need to talk about our workers' dignity as well.
She says European companies like Adidas and H&M have tried to improve work conditions by signing something called the Accord on Fire and Building Safety in Bangladesh. In it, they promise they won't do business with factories that aren't up to safety standards, and it's legally binding. Kalpona Akhtar says it's made a difference.
To give you an example, like up to 2013, every year, in average, there is 200 workers who die either factory collapse or fire. 2016, it was zero.
Getting the big North American brands to be better about safety, that's been an uphill battle. They didn't sign the accord.
Like Walmart, like Gap, like BF Corporation, JCPenney, all the bigs from US, they didn't sign. They didn't.
Instead, they joined something called the Alliance for Bangladesh Workers' Safety. Unlike the accord, it's not legally binding, and it's been criticized for having less teeth. The Alliance and the Accord cover nearly 2,000 factories, and there are as many as 7,000 factories in operation. But Kalpona Akhtar says the buck stops with the consumer. Consumers need to demand accountability.
Start with the store managers. Ask him, I wanted to know more about this worker, whether they paid a living wage. Are these workers safe?
Arati Baladas doesn't believe that factories in Bangladesh are any safer now than when the Rana building collapsed on her. She says she'll never go back to the factory, and no child of hers will go either. But in this country, almost all roads lead to the factory. Sometimes at night, Arati Baladas says a strange itch wakes her up. Phantom limbs are common in amputees. She swears she can feel her toes. She reaches down, only to find nothing. For the world, Jasmine Garst, Dhaka, Bangladesh.
That story doesn't make you think twice about where our clothes come from. Not sure what would. And that's our goal with our series this week. We've been asking you to flip your tag and find out more about where your clothes come from and who makes them. And there's an app for that designed by the Australian company Good On You. Sandra Capone is the co-founder of the company. Hey, Sandra.
Hi, Marco.
So your app rates clothing brands, supply chain transparency, treatment of animals, and labor policies. And you've loaned this app to us here at The World. I've also got in our studio Alex Newman, our digital guru, who's been coordinating all of this information and data and making it easier for you to access. So let me turn to you first, Alex. If we come to PRI.org and see this app, what do we actually see?
Well, so we built a quiz called How Fair Is Your Fashion? It allows you to put in kind of what's on the back of your label. So you can look at what country it came from, the brand it is, and the material it's made out of. But the way we did that was using some of the brand database that Good On You was able to lend to us, because it's impossible for us to evaluate the thousands of brands that exist in the world. And so it just gives you some insight into how ethical your clothing can be.
Right. And you'll find out whether it's good or whether you should really like stay away from this brand altogether. So, Sandra, as co-founder of Good On You, I imagine a lot of this involves digging on your part and knowing what brands, even specifically possibly factories, are in compliance with your standards. How do you get all that information?
That's exactly right.
We build off the work of the standards and certification schemes that are already out there, that already have teams of auditors that look at supply chains and to understand how brands and retailers are implementing sustainable practices. We also have our own team called Ethical Detectives. Mm. Their role is to scour this publicly available information, and we rate into a simple, accessible score that's useful for shoppers. From one, we avoid this brand, to five, it's great. You know, way to think about it is we put ourselves in the shoes of the consumer who, if they had a lot of time on their hands, they would also be able to find this information. But the value we add is making it really easy for them.
Sandra, what made you realize that the world needed an app like this?
For a long time, I've personally been thinking about the impact that each of us have on the world, you know, good and the bad. I've always loved fashion, but I started learning more and more about what was going on behind the scenes of the major labels. And then, of course, there was the Rana Plaza collapse in Bangladesh. And it really made me stop and think that surely fashion didn't have to come at the cost of people's lives.
Sandra, what about the companies who are making these clothes? Have they changed their kind of manufacturing processes in response?
Yeah, I think in response to the growing consumer awareness and sentiment around these issues, retailers and brands are having to step up and respond. And there's a number that are showing real leadership, but others are too slow to move. So, you know, we think there's a real role for consumers to play in continuing to push that change.
I was kind of surprised, Sandra, that some high-end companies did not do very well in your ratings, and yet some rather inexpensive companies did do quite well. Tell us about that. Is there any relationship between cost of a garment and ethics?
I think it is important to recognize that every time we purchase an item of clothing, that there is a person behind that process. And if something is really inexpensive, then somebody is paying the price for that. Mm. One of the things that we believe we do at Good On You is debunk the myth that ethical clothing needs to be expensive. Ethics is not the only consideration when we shop for clothes. You and I care also about price and style, of course. And there's plenty of examples of great brands out there that are still, you know, recognizing that people value price and are not doing that at the cost of basic sustainable principles and fairness principles for their workers.
So help me out here with a real-time garment decision. My winter puffer coat, it's 17 years old. I love it. I need to replace it, though, and I love the brand. I know where to get it locally, but the brand's not on the app. Can I ask the retailer? Will I get an honest answer?
I mean, absolutely. It'd be great to ask the retailer because that's a way that you're showing that you care about the issue. And any good retailer would respond to what their customers are asking for. You can also request through the Good On You app that we rate the brand for you. And, you know, we try and respond to our users' requests for rating brands fairly quickly. And another great thing you can do when you look up the brand in the Good On You app and are maybe not so happy with the score or the performance of the brand on some of the issues that you care about, you can send feedback directly to the brand, urging them to do better. And you can discover more ethical alternatives also through the app.
Sandra Capone, co-founder of Good On You, speaking with us from Melbourne. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Marco and Alex. It's been great to talk to you.
And Alex, thank you for being here. Alex, our digital guru here at The World.
Thank you.
Okay, now it's your turn. If you want to take our How Fair Is Your Fashion quiz, it's real easy. Just head over to PRI.org, flip your tag, and see what you can learn. Here's a quick update to a story we told you about yesterday. It's about the U.S. backing out of the U.N.'s New York Declaration for Refugees and Migrants. That is a non-binding agreement that calls for countries to respect the human rights of immigrants and create a new global framework for migration. The Trump administration wants out, but apparently several American cities want in. According to Foreign Policy, they include New York, L.A., Chicago, Dallas, Washington, D.C., and a few others. One New York City official told FP, quote, "While our national government may decline to engage the international community on this crisis, it is imperative that cities join the conversation," end of quote. Israeli and Palestinian views on Trump's decision on Jerusalem. That's coming up next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. President Trump announced a major change to U.S. foreign policy today.
Today, we finally acknowledge the obvious, that Jerusalem is Israel's capital. This is nothing more or less than a recognition of reality. It is also the right thing to do. It's something that has to be done.
And with that, Trump threw out what had been a cornerstone of American Mideast diplomacy for almost seven decades. In that time, the status of Jerusalem was something the U.S. insisted needed to be negotiated between Israelis and Palestinians, who both claim the city as their rightful capital. Today, Trump switched gears in practical terms, too.
I am also directing the State Department to begin preparation to move the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
A lot of Israelis welcomed today's announcement from President Trump. That includes Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and many of his supporters. The mayor's office in Jerusalem praised Trump, and they lit up the walls of the old city with the American flag tonight. I'm joined in the studio by the world's Matthew Bell. He lived in Jerusalem when he was our Middle East correspondent. We also want to hear from people in Jerusalem. And Matthew, we start with Daniel Seideman, someone you knew when you lived there. Tell us briefly about him.
Daniel is someone I like to hear about some of these issues in Jerusalem because he has spent many years working on this stuff as a lawyer, as an activist. He has a lot of contacts. He cares deeply about the city.
Daniel Seideman, thanks for being with us. I've been asking this question, and it may sound disingenuous, but Israelis across the political spectrum from left to right, they pretty much all agree that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. So not to oversimplify this, but what is the big deal if the American president comes out and says Jerusalem is the capital?
Look, as an Israeli, for me, it's the capital of Israel. But for the international community, since 1948, the status of Jerusalem will be determined in the framework of an agreement between ourselves and the Palestinians. Now, if I look outside the window at the moment, I see a city that is divided, binational, contested, unsustainable, and no hollow gesture of recognizing or moving a capital is going to change that. What will change that? A conflict-ending permanent status agreement in which Israeli Jerusalem will indeed be the capital of Israel, and Al-Quds, East Jerusalem, will be the capital of Palestine. That's when the embassies will come to Jerusalem, and not one moment before.
Daniel, Matthew here. What changes if President Trump says something that so many people already sort of live in reality, right? That logistically, Jerusalem, as you mentioned, is functionally the capital of Israel. If Donald Trump says it is, you know, when you wake up tomorrow, what's different?
Number one, President Trump says, all I'm doing is taking a hard look at reality. Well, he's taking a hard selective look at reality. Israel annexed the land of East Jerusalem in 1967, we didn't annex the population. 40% of the people in this town don't have the right to vote. They're not citizens. They're not entitled to become citizens. And if I can be Lincolnian for a moment, a house divided against itself cannot stand, half occupied and half free. Why is President Trump capable of seeing the capital of Israel and incapable of seeing occupied eastern part of the city? There's something even more detrimental, I would say devastating. What does Israel need? Another building in Jerusalem, an embassy? Or do we need a fair broker who will help us soberly, pragmatically, painfully progress towards a conflict-ending agreement between ourselves and the Palestinians? If the United States recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, Trump will be disqualifying himself and the United States from any significant role as a broker in Middle East, Israel-Palestine political processes. I think that that is a devastating blow to Israel and undermines our vital national interests.
That was Daniel Seideman speaking with us from Jerusalem. We've got on the line now Palestinian-Canadian lawyer Diana Boutu, who is a former spokeswoman for the Palestine Liberation Organization. Diana, I gather you listened to the president's speech. The big question for me is, do you think he left the door open to Jerusalem at some point becoming a shared capital for both Israelis and Palestinians?
No, not at all. I think his speech was very clear. He is kowtowing to a very right-wing version of Israel. He wants to make sure that there are no negotiations, and he's actually closed off any avenue for negotiations. But more importantly, he's sending the message to Israel that might is right, that they can seize land in violation of international law. And with time, that seizure will be recognized. This is why there isn't a single embassy that is in Jerusalem. This is why not a single country has recognized Jerusalem as its capital, because a basic premise of international law is that you can't acquire territory by force.
What about the parts in the speech? My ears perked up when he mentioned peace, he mentioned moderation and tolerance. He said a two-state solution is something the United States will support if the parties agree. He talked about protecting the status quo for the holy sites in the old city. At some point, Diana, did you catch yourself agreeing with Trump?
No, not at all. Protecting the status quo and the holy sites has been an Israeli talking point for quite some time. It's very fine and dandy to say that you support a two-state solution and that you want to see a two-state solution. But what Trump and his predecessors have done has made sure that there is never going to be a two-state settlement. And this is because they continue to reward Israel, even though Israel continues to build and expand settlements. So the approach that should have been taken today was to put sanctions on Israel. But instead, what he's doing is he's punishing the weaker party, being the Palestinians, and saying to them that he would like to see a two-state solution, but only if the parties agree. And what that is doing is saying to Israel, you can continue to build and expand settlements. And given that they don't want to see a Palestinian state, we're going to be in this for a very long period of time. And that's what Trump has done, is he's continued to perpetuate conflict and is now sending the message that might is right.
Diana, for you personally, what does Jerusalem mean as a city? And how does that meaning change today with this announcement from Trump?
Yeah, I first moved to Jerusalem some 15 years ago. And at the time, it was a very vibrant, very lovely, warm, welcoming place, at least the eastern part of the city. Over the years, I've seen the city completely transformed into a place where there are no playgrounds because we can't build any playgrounds, there isn't any space, to places where I've seen friends evicted from their homes, and you feel the life being sucked out of Jerusalem. What today's announcement is going to do is take it even a step further. He's now feeding into those elements that don't want to see any Palestinian presence in Jerusalem. And so I fear what tomorrow is going to bring. I fear that he is going to continue to fan the flames of people who don't even want to see Palestinians in their midst. I don't even want to think about what that will mean.
Palestinian-Canadian lawyer Diana Buttu in Jerusalem. Thanks very much for speaking with Matthew and me.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, the French rock star who tried to be more American than Elvis.
He was a biker. He had the leather, the like jean jacket, etc. And like you would see album covers with Route 66 and everything American, you know.
He was the incomparable Johnny Hallyday. We hear from one of his legion of French fans still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. 11 weeks ago, Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico after we heard the predictions, and yes, still now there are parts of the island that have not recovered. One matrix, the electricity is still out for more than 30% of the territory. That's according to the Puerto Rican government. We want to get behind those headlines, though, to hear what living on the island feels like right now.
You get tired of eating cold stuff or eating things in a can or not being able even to have a warm bath. It's the little things that you miss the most.
That's Edmaris Carrazo, born and raised in Puerto Rico. Edmaris works in marketing in San Juan, where she writes the blog Siempre Jueves.
It is still a crisis. It's not fair to think that we're all over this. More than half of the country still have no power. Last Saturday, my in-laws got electricity for the first time in 90 days.
Wow.
But it comes and goes. So we still, like, for example, we disconnect all the appliances because we're kind of scared of how the energy comes and goes. So even if you have it, it's not normal at all. So you cannot really like make a big grocery store shopping because you're not sure if you're going to have a steady electricity. And on the offices, we all work now from 8 to 5 because there's no electricity before or after that. So at 4:55, we scream each other like, save everything, because the Wi-Fi is going down and the electricity is going down too. Some places, they still don't have any ATM or credit card system. So you still have to have cash just in case.
So you must have to budget time in your day just to wait on lines.
Well, it's crazy because usually we are impatient.
Aren't we all?
Naturally. It became normal like to be on an ATM to get some cash out. And if you see it's only like 20 people before you, it's a short line. And a couple of months ago, you wouldn't wait even for 2 people.
And with frequent blackouts, what about your refrigerator? Are you counting on it?
Well, here in the office, we have a refrigerator, but every day we move everything from the fridge to the freezer at 6 p.m. And then in the morning, we put it down.
When you run into people on the street now in San Juan, I can imagine that simple encounters between people have changed, the topic of conversation and the general mood.
We try not to complain because we know, like, you're alive. So if you're alive, you're winning. If you haven't lost, you know, a loved one, you're winning. If you still have a roof, you're actually winning because there's a lot of people that do not have a roof yet. And even when people are sending a lot of supplies, they're getting wet because they do not have a shelter.
Wow. Ed Morris, are you angry?
I'm a little bit over the angry face. I've been very angry. I've been very upset, very disappointed, frustrated. I'm kind of in the acceptance stage. You could see how people were changing their perspective every day in the way that they drive their cars.
Explain
like
that.
The first days, everyone was very nice about it. Like, yeah, go ahead. Trying not to rush things, trying to be safe. But we're over that. And people are already driving crazy. Our tolerance and patience, it's kind of empty.
And yet what little I know of Puerto Rico, I imagine people are leaning on one another quite a bit. I mean, you wrote about some impromptu gatherings like one the other day in a plaza. Tell us about that.
If you find someone in the street and they tell you that they still don't have water or they don't have energy and you do, you always invite them over to go laundry or I can freeze you some water bottles. That's the way we are. Even the people that don't have enough, they will try to share. And there's actually, I feel like a sense of guilt. My mom had her power and her water back 2 weeks after the hurricane because she lives close to a hospital. And she used to tell me that she felt embarrassed that she has, you know, her energy and her water back and people didn't.
One last thing I want to ask you about something you alluded to in something you wrote, crying. Are more people crying in public than before? And how do people react now when they see somebody crying?
I think it's normal to see people crying on the cards. Puerto Ricans, we try to laugh. You know, we party if we win, we party if we lose. We are people that like to help each other, and we're people that like to gather up. We were saying the other day, like, this is going to be a great Christmas season, even if we don't have power, because we need this. We need to feel that we still have things to celebrate. You feel sad, but you will not allow sadness to win over you.
Ed Morris Carrazo, born and raised in Puerto Rico. We're thinking of you and the island. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for taking the time of listening.
In addition to all of the hardships for the people living on the island, the damage from Hurricane Maria is having a ripple effect on the mainland. Hospitals here are dealing with shortages because Puerto Rico is a major manufacturer of medications and medical supplies, intravenous fluids, for example, and the shortages are getting worse. Here's reporter Ibi Caputo.
The day before Thanksgiving, doctors at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston received an email urging them to conserve IV fluids as much as possible. The email read, "We have now reached a point where the shortage is of potential operational concern." That means doctors have to start doing things differently.
So where we can conserve, let's conserve.
Chris Fortier is the chief pharmacist at Mass General.
Let's make sure we're reserving our products for the patients that we need them for. And when we can use other alternatives that are as equally as effective as the product in an IV fluid, let's do that.
IV fluids like saline and dextrose are the lifeblood of hospitals. They're needed to deliver medications and rehydrate patients. Hospital pharmacies use the smaller IV bags to mix medications. The smaller bags have been in short supply, though, especially since the hurricane. So pharmacists have relied on the larger bags. But now larger bags are running low, too.
Every day is sort of a moving target. Some days we expect to get product and we don't. Some days we expect to get a lot of product and we only get some of it.
In an emailed statement, a spokesperson at Baxter said that one of their factories in Puerto Rico is still being powered by a diesel generator. And while the other two are back on the electrical grid, power is still intermittent. Severe damage to roads and bridges is also slowing the recovery. The FDA is temporarily allowing IV saline products to be imported from Baxter's factories in other countries, but it's unclear how much relief that will provide. And that's left hospitals across the U.S. scrambling.
As you can see, we're hoarding solutions here.
Deb Sadowski is the director of pharmacy at Deborah Heart and Lung Center, a small hospital a mile from Fort Dix in New Jersey. Outside her office are stacks of boxes labeled Baxter. They'd usually be stored in the hospital's central supply. Sadowski says the boxes contain small IV fluid bags, and they're being kept in the pharmacy so they're not mistakenly sent to hospital floors.
You know, they can use a bigger bag. We can't use a bigger bag.
When Sadowski says they can use a bigger bag, she means nurses on the hospital floors who need IV fluids to, say, rehydrate a patient. Other substitutions include injecting medication with a syringe when possible and assessing whether a patient can take meds in a pill form. According to the FDA, there have been shortages of IV fluids on and off since 2014 for a variety of reasons, but nothing like this. In November, the American Hospital Association sent a letter to Congress stating that the U.S. healthcare system was, quote, on the brink of a significant public health crisis.
I think it's about to hit critical mass in, you know, over the next week or two. There's just no more to be had. And so you can only go so far with your conservation methods. We're all doing everything that we can do.
Pharmacists also worry the ripple effects of Hurricane Maria won't stop with IV fluids. Puerto Rico produces more pharmaceuticals for the mainland than any of the 50 states and more than any single foreign country. That's according to an FDA economic analysis released last month. Cancer drugs and IV medication are among the products manufactured on the still devastated island. Mass General pharmacist Chris Fortier says it's difficult to prepare for potential shortages because the FDA does not require companies to disclose where their drugs are made.
We are concerned about other plants in Puerto Rico that made drugs, and will those products go on shortage? We don't know.
Hospitals say patient care is not being compromised, but they don't expect the shortage to let up, at least until early next year. For The World, I'm Ibi Caputo.
There are a couple of places in the world that are almost synonymous with tax haven, such as Luxembourg or the Cayman Islands, where U.S. corporations have long been parking their money to avoid U.S. taxes. But things are looking up if you've got billions offshore. If the proposed Republican tax plan becomes law, giant companies like Google, Apple, and General Electric would be able to bring nearly $3 trillion in profits home and benefit from tax breaks. Chai-Ching Huang is a tax policy analyst with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
There's a strange feature of the U.S. tax code that effectively allows U.S. multinationals to choose when to pay tax on their foreign profits. They only face U.S. corporate taxes on them when they have declared them to have been repatriated back to the U.S. Now, for most of them, that's just an accounting change on their books because a lot of these profits are actually invested in things that are part of the U.S. economy, but these are profits that they book in tax havens like the ones that you mentioned and then don't face U.S. tax on them until they bring them home.
And what is the tax rate if they do bring them home currently?
It's a statutory rate of 35%, and then they get tax credits for any foreign tax that they've paid, so there's no double tax. But if they've been booking those profits in places like Luxembourg, the Cayman Islands, they haven't been paying any foreign taxes or very, very little foreign taxes on them, so they face a significant U.S. tax charge to repatriate those profits.
So tell us about the repatriation provision in the tax overhaul package that the Republicans are proposing.
So there's about $2.8 trillion of these foreign profits currently booked offshore. And the tax bills would say that we're going to subject them to a one-time tax rate. Now, that tax rate is much, much lower than the current 35% statutory rate. So in the Senate, it's a top rate of 14.5% for cash and 7.5% for other types of investments.
Republicans argue that the repatriation provision will help create jobs. What do you think of that argument?
Well, we know that that's a promise that is unlikely to bear fruit because we've been through this before. In 2004, Congress enacted a so-called tax holiday, which actually gave a tax cut on those profits to lure companies back. And multinationals repatriated more than $300 billion in profits at a greatly reduced tax rate. And there are multiple independent academic studies that showed that they didn't increase investment, didn't increase jobs. In fact, the top 15 repatriating corporations cut their U.S. workforces by 21,000 people in the 3 years after the holiday.
So if all of this goes through, what would happen to profits that are acquired after the ruling? Like, would a company's accrue revenue and each time they want to bring the profit home, they'd have to pay another tax?
Not only is it a problem that there's been a discounted rate on past profits, but the proposal is to transition to a system that would give a permanently lower rate to any foreign profits that US multinationals make. So the Senate bill, for example, sets a 20% corporate tax rate on US profits, but a rate of 10% or less on foreign profits. So there will be a large permanent incentive to shift profits offshore. The Senate bill has set up a few different so-called guardrails to try to prevent that. The thing that's ironic about those guardrails is that it actually creates new incentives to shift real operations offshore in order to get the low tax rate. You're not subject to this minimum 10% tax on foreign profits if the profits are from manufacturing offshore. The thing that is incredibly important about the way that this bill has been moved through is that it has been incredibly rushed. I think we're going to see a whole lot of loopholes come into the light of day.
Loopholes like what? Can you name one?
Steve Shea at Harvard University has pointed out that the repatriation provision that we've been talking about, the difference between the rate on cash and non-cash investments can be pretty easily gamed. So there's a whole lot of ways for companies to sort of pretend that their offshore investments are non-cash and get the even lower rate through that.
Instead of 14.5 down to 7%.
That's exactly right. And that's just really the start.
So remind us what all this means, if you would, Cha-Ching, for the U.S. tax base and this country's ability to do things like improving schools or building bridges.
That's a hugely important question. And you can see that from the official cost estimates that these international tax provisions are a hugely costly long-run lead on the U.S. Treasury. They're covered up within the 10-year budget window that Congress looks at when they're passing bills by, as I said, some gimmicks, including one-time revenues. But this represents a long-term loss and an undermining of the ability to invest in things that would strengthen the economy.
Cha-Ching Huang, a tax policy analyst with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thanks very much. This was really helpful.
Thanks very much for having me.
Here's a quick preview of a story we'll have for you tomorrow on the show about a Florida town with a beautiful beach but no hotel. Residents say they want their beach to just be a beach.
And we preserve 40% of our oceanfront in conservation, so it will never be built on, whether it be a single-family home or a hotel.
But turns out they are building a hotel, a small one, running on solar power, built with a minimal carbon footprint. Is that enough? This construction expert thinks any kind of building near the water needs to be limited.
Even in Miami today, where there's the signs of climate change everywhere, there's a building boom going on, but there's no negative signals being sent to make it financially difficult for people to build in these areas or even banning construction in certain areas.
The global climate crisis, our story from Florida on tomorrow's show. KSM Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, self-described architect of the 9/11 attacks, captured in Pakistan in 2003, transferred to Guantanamo 3 years later, and the subject of a long legal drama there ever since. In fact, pre-trial hearings are still going on for KSM and his co-conspirators 16 years after the attacks. My colleague here at WGBH, Arun Roth, has been to Gitmo several times to report on the proceedings. He's down there right now for the 26th pre-trial hearing. 26, that's incredible, and no actual trial yet. Is that right, Arun?
That's right, and it seems like the earliest trial date they're talking about is 2019, so still a ways away.
And why is the 26 pretrial hearing important? Why are you covering this?
Well, one of the things that's been interesting with this is that, you know, this is a trial that's about 9/11. And even though it's been going on for 5 years now, there's been relatively little talk about what happened that day. As you know from many of our conversations we've had over these years, that much of it has been bogged down in courtroom procedure. And an awful lot of that has been taken up by the defense attorneys for these five men who are on trial, trying to get as much evidence as they can about their abuse in CIA custody. There's been so much time spent on that. And that's upset some people who feel like America is being put on trial rather than these five men who allegedly attacked it.
There was a lot of 9/11 discussion yesterday. Tell us what you heard.
Yeah, it was really kind of getting into some details. We heard testimony from Special Agent James Fitzgerald. He was an FBI agent who interrogated these detainees. And he testified yesterday actually not about that interrogation, but about a lot of the precipitating events that led up to 9/11. Going back to 1998, the embassy bombings in Tanzania and Kenya. And this is all towards establishing that the U.S. was at war with al-Qaeda on September 11th, 2001. The reason that they're doing that is because they need to establish that we were at war with al-Qaeda for this court to have jurisdiction.
Is this your first trip back to Guantanamo since President Trump took office?
It is, Marco. The last time that I was here was December of last year, almost exactly a year ago, so right before he took office.
What's different? What seems different?
But one thing I got to say that is interesting, that things are essentially operating the same way they did under President Obama. And what I mean by that is that, remember during the campaign, Mr. Trump said that he was going to send more prisoners here. He was going to load it up with bad dudes. Well, he hasn't done that. And he's had the opportunity. There have been a number of foreign terrorist suspects who have been nabbed since he took office. None of them have been sent here. One of the suspects in the Benghazi attack, who was captured by U.S. commandos back in October, a week after he was captured, he was charged in a federal court in Washington, D.C. So weirdly, it seems that Trump and Sessions appear to be adopting the Obama holder approach to prosecuting terrorists.
Arun Roth with WGBH speaking with us from Guantanamo Bay on the ongoing trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Arun, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
Johnny Hallyday just might be the biggest rock star you've never heard of. At least that's what people said about him for years. The French singer died last night at the age of 74. Okay, in France, they know him real well. A certain generation there absolutely loves him. Hallyday sold more than 100 million albums, packed stadiums for decades. His career never really took off in the U.S., even though he modeled himself kind of as a corny Elvis Presley. Malcolm Urie may disagree with me on that one. He's French and works and lives here in Boston, but grew up in Paris. So a corny version of Elvis, is that fair or is it offensive?
probably not offensive, but like corny is maybe a like little harsh there. He definitely tried to like stage himself as this American rock star, you know, like he was a biker, he had the leather, the like jean jacket, etc. And like you would see album covers about like Route 66 and everything American, you know.
He had the whole kit, and apparently French people love that. I know he had hundreds of songs, but what I'd like you to do for us is just build up a little playlist of Johnny Hallyday so we can get a sense of who he is. What's one song that really stands out for you, Malcolm?
Well, there's definitely one of the first song maybe I heard of Johnny would be like Allumer le Feu, which is like his more recent work. Like this is the song that was made to pack stadiums, you know.
Light the fire,
you know. And this guy, he played under the Eiffel Tower to the year 2000 New Year's Eve in front of like 3 million people. And that was definitely like a big, big stage song. Allumer le Feu. Sentir le vent qui se déchaîne, battre le sang dans nos veines, monter le son des guitares.
It's hardcore rock and roll. What is Hallyday singing about here?
Allumer le Feu, it's a big party song. So you would like hear it at weddings. There wouldn't be like a like wedding in France without Allumer le Feu. Like it feels a very like energetic song.
Light the fire, get this party started. So how is Johnny Hallyday perceived today in France? I mean, aside from someone who was on the cover, it seemed, of Paris Match like every year at least.
I would say that Johnny Hallyday is like part of, regardless of how you actually personally feel about him, like he's just part of it. He's like as big of a deal as Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley. Like whether or not you like Johnny Hallyday is actually irrelevant. He's there. Everybody knows about him. He's been there forever. I think he started his first songs in 1960 or something. Like still today, everybody knows about him.
So we just heard his big stadium anthem. If you had one Johnny Hallyday song to point to and say, this is who he is, what song would that be?
There's this song about, which is called On a tous en nous quelque chose de Tennessee.
That's something about Tennessee?
Something about Tennessee. And it's actually apparently not about the state, more about the like playwright. But yeah,
Tennessee Williams.
Yes, it definitely sounds very blues American. Yeah, that would be definitely a good pick there. And he used to still play it live this year.
On a tous quelque chose en nous de Tennessee. Cette volonté de prolonger la nuit, ce désir fou de vivre une autre vie, ce rêve en nous avec ses mots à lui, quelque chose de Tennessee.
Something about Tennessee. I mean, only a French rock and roll star would write a song about Tennessee, but it'd really be about Tennessee Williams.
Yeah.
What do you think people in France loved about this song?
I think they mistakenly think that it's about Tennessee,
the state.
So it definitely feels about this whole, like, Johnny Hallyday impersonating the American writer.
So let's wrap up this playlist with one more Johnny Hallyday song to sign off with today. What are you going to choose?
This song called Toute la musique que j'aime.
All the music that I love. The Johnny Hallyday classic, Malcolm Urie. I don't know if this is the beginning of the official Boston chapter of the Johnny Hallyday fan club.
Maybe.
But I certainly thank you for coming in and for telling us all about Johnny Hallyday.
Thank you so much for having me.
Adieu, Johnny. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.